The book is Loud. That's the title, Loud. Retired talk show host Angelo Cataldi, now an author. The subtitle of the book refers to his bond with you, the listeners who'd call his show.
But there were the fans, and they were handing it down from generation to generation. And when I got to that point, I realized now we can really bond. And we did. And that when I would go crazy, they would get a little crazier. When they would go crazy, I would get crazier. And the volume got louder. And that was my goal. And it worked.
The hate, the love, the insanity of it all. Angelo Cataldi dishes about the players, the coaches, and about himself. Next on Fresh 24.
Sixers lock all windows and doors.
Angelo Cataldi, retired radio legend, 33 years on WIP, erstwhile sports writer, lover, hater, shit stirrer, father, husband, grandfather, and now you're an author. Look at you. The book is called Loud, How a Shy Nerd Came to Philadelphia and Turned Up the Volume in the Most Passionate Sports City in America. Ange.
Yep.
Look at you, at the ready. You have no compunction, man.
It's a new thing for me, Mark. It's brand new for me. I've never done anything like this. It's so weird.
Yeah, now you're getting great practice. I mean, you're all over the place. I know you got some signings coming up. We'll talk about that. Let me ask you real quick. You miss it?
Once or twice. Not often. I missed it when I found out that Jonathan Gannon was negotiating a contract at the Arizona Cardinals while we were all praying the Eagles could win another Super Bowl. I wanted to come back that day and rip his butt. I mean, I wanted to slaughter him that day. And when my old radio station, WIP, did a campaign to give a standing ovation to Trey Turner when he was hitting about 230, making $300 million, I would have made every effort then to sabotage that. Although history has proven it was exactly the right thing to do, which told me, Mark, that it was time, the right time to leave was when I did, because the world is changing and I am not.
Well, listen, we're going to get into it all. We're going to get into the criticism, the love, the hate, the tomfoolery. But I got to ask you, the subtitle of the book, How Did a Shy Nerd Come to Philadelphia and Turn Up the Volume in the Most Passionate Sports City in America? Answer the question. How?
It took a while, and over a long period of time, Mark, I finally realized that I had to create a bond. I had to speak the language of the fans in this amazing sports town. And once I did, I'd say it was about 10, 12 years in when I really got that point where I was on the same page with them. I realized the stars of my radio show were the callers. Those were the fans, because they're the constant. They're the ones that are there. None of the players, none of the owners, none of the coaches, none of those guys lasted the 33 years I was there. There was nobody still standing. But there were the fans, and they were handing it down from generation to generation. And when I got to that point, I realized now we can really bond. And we did. And that when I would go crazy, they would get a little crazier. When they would go crazy, I would get crazier. And the volume got louder. And that was my goal. And it worked.
It certainly did. In fact, I want to thank you for having me on your show a number of times. I have to tell you, as a fellow broadcaster, I couldn't do what you did the way you did it, but I certainly have great respect for what you did and how you did it. And now let's get into it. Are you ready?
Yes.
Chronologically speaking, you grew up in Providence, Rhode Island. Your father's a Yankees fan of all things, and Providence might as well be Boston or Greater Boston. You grew up a Sixers fan in Celtics territory. How did that happen?
So my father was a Yankees fan, but more than that, he was an Italians fan. There was an Italian athlete, and there weren't that many. My dad was a big supporter. We were contrarians because I was a Yankee fan in Red Sox territory. So it extended to pretty much everything. And when it came to the Celtics, my father decided that he didn't like them because he didn't like the Red Sox. So I did whatever my dad told me. He was a real strong Italian guy. And so I went along with it. And I went to the arena, this dank, nasty-looking place in Providence where one day the Celtics played the Sixers in that arena. It was a regular season game back then, Mark. Hmm. The Celtics would move out from Boston Garden. And what was great about it for me was that I got to see Wilt. I got down near the court, and I watched Wilt Chamberlain, 7 feet, 2 inches. And he was about 17 feet from the basket on the side. And he was like a machine. He would just shoot bank shot, bank shot, bank shot. Never missed. For 10 mm-hmm. minutes, he never missed. And I went, oh, my God. So I started to look into him. And I went, oh, look, he's the best player in the game. He's got all the records. And I fell in love. And he was my mm-hmm. favorite athlete then. And all these years later, long after he's passed, he's still my favorite. I love him.
Yeah.
And people that don't think he was the greatest player, they just didn't live back then to see it. He was the greatest basketball player of all time.
Mm. Wow. Let me say this. I just remember as a kid doing the same thing at Civic Center Convention Hall. Going down at halftime, he's warming up and trying to measure myself from about 20 feet away, coming up to his waist. But then I wanted to be the announcer for the 76ers. You, at some point, decided to become a sports writer. When did it hit you?
Well, it hit me when I got on a basketball court or I got on a baseball field and I realized, well, we're not going to be doing anything here. But I love sports. I loved it. So I went, oh, how can I get involved? So I said, well, you know what? What are my choices here? I don't have the great broadcaster voice that you do, Mark. I couldn't do that thing. So I said, I love writing. I'll cover it. And that was the goal from the time I went to undergrad at the University of Rhode Island. I knew that I wanted to go into writing and I wanted to write about sports.
And you did. In fact, you wrote for your hometown paper in Providence. And then you came to Philly. Why?
At that point, I didn't connect with my own hometown, believe it or not, because it's more hero worship up there. At least it was when I was there. There was not a lot of negativity, and I liked the boo as much as I liked the cheer. And when I got a call from the Philadelphia Inquirer, I had won some a column writing award, and when I got a call from them, I went, oh, that's the perfect city for me. There all these amazing writers, great columnists, and guys that suffer, no fools. These guys are tough. That will be the perfect fit for me. So they didn't have to ask twice. Even though I started covering hockey the first year and I didn't even know what hockey was, I did it to come to Philadelphia because I thought it was a better fit for me.
In fact, at the Inquirer, you were a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize because you caught Eagles coach Buddy Ryan lying. Explain that, please.
All right. I'm embarrassed now. If I'd have won the Pulitzer, they would have taken it back by now because I completely misread what he was doing. I went to Columbia University. They said to me, we don't think you should go into sports, but if you do, would you handle it the way you would if you covered City Hall or White House, somebody big? Would you go there and hold him accountable? Ask the tough questions. So I did it. And it wasn't well received in the sports community. I had a lot of altercations with players that I covered and things like that. And when I got to Buddy and he was making all these bold statements, my journalism said, well, hold him accountable. So at mid-season of the first year, I wrote a very tough analysis, which basically said he lied to us. He lied to us. He lied to us. Well, most of the fans knew that. They knew the Eagles weren't going to win every game in their division. They were a lousy team that he inherited. So I wrote a very hard-hitting piece, and I put that together with everything else I had done that year, and my bosses submitted it. And I came pretty close to winning, believe it or not. I guess they had never really acknowledged sports at the Pulitzer level. Plus, I had a home field advantage. Pulitzer was decided by Columbia, where I went. And right. It's just a damn good thing I didn't win. Because A, Buddy Ryan turned Philadelphia into even more of an Eagles town than ever had been before. He did a lot of good for the interest level in the Eagles. And if I had won it, none of the radio stuff could have happened, because when you have that on your resume, you write books a lot sooner than I did, and you have a more serious approach than I did, and that never would have fit for me. I wasn't that serious. I was looking for a way to do what I ended up doing at WIP.
Okay, let's talk about that, because you were thriving in newspapers. You worked for your hometown. You worked in Philly. You had several beats. You had offers from other papers. And yet, for some reason, you ventured into this new radio format in the 80s, sports radio. Why on earth would you do that?
$20,000.
Oh, or I think you got, what, 75 bucks for your first show?
75 bucks for the first show. But then when we dazzled people, after 2 years, and Tom Brookshire was saying, well, I got to bring somebody in here so I can leave soon, because how he would not do that forever. He was getting up at 4 a.m. When that first started, I was making 55 grand at the Inquirer, and they offered me 75 grand at the WIP. And I took a journalism career with some really good stuff on my resume, and I flushed it for $20,000. And it's set a pattern of me always doing stuff for money for the rest of my life, including this book.
All right. But listen, in the beginning, the sledding was a little bit rough. First of all, some background for the youngsters. Tom Brookshire, defensive back for the Eagles, has since passed, played for the 60 team, became a huge star on the networks, and helped to get the WIP sports radio format off the ground. You're teaming with him now in the mornings. And at one point, you wrote this in your book, Brookshire, this is Brookshire talking to you, and he said, after one of those early shows, he said, I'm getting tired of carrying your sorry ass, he grunted as he gathered his gear and left the studio. When he said to you, I'm tired of carrying your sorry ass, how did that make you feel?
Well, initially very angry, and then as I pondered the situation, I realized that I hadn't really made a commitment to radio. I was just in a way station, Mark. I was waiting to go back into newspapers. I didn't see it as a long-term solution to my career situation. And frankly, the money wasn't as thrilling once I got it. You know, so I was like, what am I going to do? And he woke me up. I mean, he really did. I think his original plan was to leave after 1 year. And he realized that he couldn't hand it off to me. I didn't know anything. He was carrying us. From that point on, it changed. From that point on, I became more assertive. He cleared the way for me. He was grooming me because he really didn't want to do it long term. And he mentored me. And he showed me so many things that you need to know to make that connection with your audience. Because, man, the city of Philadelphia always did and always will love Tom Brookshire. And I learned a lot from him by having that extra year with him.
You learned a little bit, too, from Al Morgani, who, of course, is another newspaper guy, but really your longest-running partner in the morning show. And you said in your book that he taught you how to cause trouble. What did you mean by that?
Well, he is, by nature, a quiet rabble-rouser. He does it with practical jokes, and he tells people things that aren't true to get reactions and stuff like that. But even more than that, I have intelligence, but it's not practical intelligence. It's not street intelligence. Whenever we had decisions to make that were important for the show, Al Morgani's word carried. I deferred to him on all that stuff. Now, there's a couple of times where I tried to deviate. One was when 1993, 94, we get a job offer. I get a job offer. They come to me first, WEEI in Boston. We want to bring you guys to Boston. You're going to be our morning show. We're going to kill it. I went, where's the contract? I'll sign. They were talking much better money. Go to Al. If you're going, you're going alone.
Oh.
What do you mean? And you got to understand, Al never... mentally never left Boston. He still roots for all the Boston teams except the Celtics. He doesn't like the Celtics. And he goes back to Boston every chance he can get. And he said, our show would not work in Boston. And furthermore, I don't want my family to hear what we're doing here. So that ended that. Mm. All the decisions, the start of Wing Ball, all the things that had the biggest impact with decisions made by Al, in which I said, whatever you think, Al, I'm on board. Because his decision-making was impeccable.
Interesting. All right, enough of the background. Let's get to the crux of the matter, or several things that I think are really interesting, including this search for the truth that really drove you throughout your career. A gentleman, Norman Isaacs, who was a mentor, or professor, I guess, for you at Columbia when you were a grad student. I happen to agree with the fact that you want to search out the truth. I mean, fundamentally, I agree with that. But let's play devil's advocate for a second. Why is truth so important in sports? I mean, it's contrived, it's entertainment, it's not politics, it's not healthcare, it's not war. Who cares? And again, this is me just playing devil's advocate.
Yep. I'm a fan. I care. If you're going to have I'm going to watch a game. After the game, there are questions in my mind about the game, what the coach did, what the players did, that kind of thing. I like honest answers to those questions. I think it's the least you can ask of these athletes, these sports figures, when they are making so much money. And that money is coming from the pockets of those fans. I think it's essential that you do it. It is not a serious enterprise like it would be if it was City Hall or the White House. But if your job as a journalist is to cover the team, then cover the team. Get the answers to the questions. Fans want those answers. I'm now retired. I still want the answers. And I think I had two different things. On the air, I was a bombast. I was a provocateur. I was a troublemaker until I got to the interview. And then I was the journalist again. And then I would ask the questions that I thought were most important to the fan. So I did have a separation there in how I did that. And I retained that for the whole time I was at WIP. My interviews were usually pretty serious.
Hmm. So here you go. Here's a philosophical question for you. And just as an aside here, you made it clear in your book that Pete Rose should not be a Hall of Famer. No. I'm correct in that, right? That's not the question. I'm just confirming that. So let's go back to 1999. You might recall it was at a baseball stadium. Baseball is naming its all-century team. You know where I'm going with this. Pete Rose is among them. He's allowed to appear because the commissioner said, all right, I'm going to make an exception on this part. Jim Gray is one of the hosts of the ceremony. And when he gets Pete on a national interview called, he says to him or asks him, hey, Pete, is it time to admit you bet on baseball? Now, you're a searcher for the truth. Was that the right thing for Jim Gray to do at the time?
No, it wasn't, because of the setting of the what they were doing in that. They were honoring. If you're doing an honor, if you're having a day for someone, you don't, you know, basically pee in the punch. You don't do it then. But you do it when you have another opportunity, you ask that question. And the thing about Pete was, he was my introduction in Philadelphia. One of the very first assignments I got was to do a piece on Pete Rose as he was approaching his 3,000th hit, which he got here in Philly. Mark, there wasn't a more accessible guy I ever met, or a guy that loved to talk his sport any more than Pete Rose loved to talk baseball. I'm not saying he wasn't a great player and wasn't all that. What finally decided it for me happened many years later when the Phillies honored him, I guess the 1980 team. And he came out and did an interview in which he was very condescending to one of the female reporters, really condescending. And you went, man, all these years have not humbled him, have not made him see that he can't act that way if he wants to return to baseball. And it just like he's in his 80s and he still hasn't figured it out. He's not going to figure it out. I'm very conflicted because baseball now is in bed with gambling. It's not what it was when he got in trouble with it. But he just hasn't been an ambassador for the sport the way he should be. And if he had found a way to just be better with that, not do the things he did, not have all these scandals come out over the years on things he had been involved in as a player, I would love to have seen him go in, but he blew it. He blew the chance.
Criticism. It's at the backbone of being a sports talk radio host, let's face it. But I can imagine through your time and time immemorial, there are players, coaches, GMs who may have said, you know, how can this guy, or maybe personalize it, say, how can Angelo criticize? He never had to tackle a 220-pound running back. He never threw a baseball, never had to guard Joel Embiid. What gave you the right to criticize?
It was the profession I decided to go into, and I gave it my all in that profession. So theater critics, movie critics are not people that necessarily make movies. You can get good enough at it, and who am I going to listen to? Like, they have this thing now where players can write about their own experiences. Derek Jeter was involved in it very early on. That's not an objective look at things. People need to see an objective look at things. And when I was a journalist, that was objective. That was hear what they have to say, assess what it is, and provide analysis on what they're doing. And I think I was in a better position to do that because I went to school to do it. I had a lot of background in it. So I guess you could say nobody who's no non-athlete should ever write about athletes. You're going to run out of people to cover stuff if you're waiting for all these great athletes to come forward. And most of the athletes are awful at talking about their own performance. So somebody's got to do it. It may as well be somebody who trained themselves to do it.
Ange, how much of the criticism, the poking fun, the dragging through the mud, all the bits and stuff with Joe Conklin, which I thought, by the way, were riotous, but how much of that was real? And how much of that was, hey, let's just do this because, I don't know, it'll make great radio or it'll create a stir or go viral or something like that?
It was real. The opinion was always real. The expression of it was amplified. And it was amplified for entertainment purposes. No matter what, you couldn't be as angry as I was every day at something. It was there. I was angry. And now, okay, now let's make this, let's connect with this. Let's make this more theatrical. And that's what I did. And over time, I figured out how to do it. Initially, if you heard some of the tapes of the first 4, 5, or 6 years of our show, it was pretty basic. It was not really very, it wasn't compelling. You know, it takes a long time to figure out how to do that. When I'm talking to kids now who want to get into this business, I have something I always tell them. And they always never heard that from anyone before. You want to go into communications. You want to go into broadcasting. Take one or more courses in drama. You understand? That's part of it. It's a performance. There's no way Mark Zumwalt was that excited every time the Sixers hit a big shot. But you were great at, you were channeling the emotion of the real fans that were in there and feeling that joy in that moment. And that's what broadcasting was for me. It was partly a performance and partly, when I was doing those interviews, still journalism.
Interesting. Well, listen, I'll say this because you did bring my name into it. I definitely had to perform, especially on nights when I just didn't feel like it, or, you know, I was sick or I had something else on my mind. Although I will say that some of those game-winning shots or some of the stuff that Iverson did, I mean, you know, I was a fan.
Great.
And it was like,
great.
For me, yeah, thank you. It was a lot of the fan coming up, but this is about you, not about me. All right. There's criticism and then there's hate. You talk about hate a lot. It's a strong word. You hated Buddy Ryan. You may have hated Phillies manager Gabe Kapler more than anybody.
Yeah.
Why do you use hate to describe your feeling for these two and others?
Because I really did. I do. Mm. I really am, was a fan. And if Gabe Kapler is coming on my radio show and is going to lie about what we all saw the day after it happened, as a fan, I feel hate. And I feel a lack of respect. And I feel that he has not just disrespected me, who was doing the interview. He disrespected everybody who cares about that team. So, yeah, it's hate. I never, here's the thing. You would say, well, if you got to know him better, if you went in the locker room, you wouldn't have those feelings. It's why I didn't go in the locker room. It's why I didn't have relationships with any of these people. With one exception, I failed one time in 33 years, and I got too close to the guy, and I couldn't rip him. And I felt terrible about it, and I made sure I never would do it again. And I know the guy is somebody you love and admire and covered for years, the former president of the Sixers, Pat Croce. It's the only time. I just couldn't help it. He was such a great people person. I just wanted him to succeed so badly. And when I had him on, you would not hear journalists. You would hear somebody who was just, you know, a PR extension of the team. But that's the only time. The rest of the time, I didn't know these people. I didn't want to know them. I was reacting to the sports figures the way the fans were, because most of them never met them. There's no reason for me to get manipulated or stroked in any way. I'm going to give you my honest opinion based on what I'm seeing, not on what I'm hearing.
You mentioned Pat, and this is obviously a Sixers-centric podcast. I got plenty of Sixers questions for you, but sure. I got some more hate stuff here, at least a couple more things.
Sure.
Tom Bigby, the legendary program director at WIP, really a driving force in what the radio station became. And I think to some degree, it's fair to say that you did hate him to the point where you actually had written into your contract a clause that said he couldn't criticize you. How did you get that past the corporate lawyers? And what did your colleagues at WIP think of that?
All right. First of all, it wasn't widely known within WIP. My agent, Steve Mountain, told me to keep it quiet. Secondly, in 1995, when my contract was running out, I did not want to continue to work for Bigby. He was a great tutor in the formatics of radio, stuff like that. He had no idea what he was talking about when it came to content. No idea whatsoever. And he would try to meddle in that. It would frustrate me, and I would have knocked down screaming matches with him. And it got to the point where I said to my agent, I think I'd be better off trying to get a job somewhere else. I want to work for this guy. He said, what if I took him out of your life? And I said, I don't know how you got to do that. He said, relax. Let me see what I can do. He came up with this clause in page 5 of the contract. I reprinted it in the book. And it became famous over time. And basically it said, if I chose to not communicate with my program director, Tom Bigby, specifically naming him, I didn't have to. And it would be in no way a breach of contract. And if he forced it on me, he would be breaching my contract. So we put it out there, and no one noticed it for 2 years. In 1997, I got a call after the first break of a show in which I started the show talking about Mike Tyson biting off the earlobe of Evander Holyfield. And I go to the hotline at the end of the segment. He says, get off this topic now. We don't talk boxing at WIP. And I told him to bleep off. And I said, fire me. And then after the show, I invoked the clause. He didn't even know it was there, Mark. He had no idea. And I did it as a strike. I struck a blow for everybody who has ever hated their bosses, because I finally had enough leverage at that point where I could literally, and CBS Radio owned it, and they never blinked an eye. They signed off on the contract on that clause without negotiation, because they knew he was a really hard guy to work with. But, you know, it's got to be one of the proudest things my agent ever did. And since I benefited from it, I'm pretty proud of it, too.
Yeah.
When you get a guy who's a complete ass, right, you got to do something about it. And if you got the leverage, then use it. And I did it.
You also admit in your book that many people hated you. Personally, I hate to be hated. Mm. Do you tolerate it? Did you revel in it? Did you just shake it off? What was it like to be hated?
I was hated by the first coach I covered in Philadelphia, Bob McCammon. He tried to attack me after I had printed a quote from Harry Sinden of the Bruins. He literally attempted to behead me, and Timmy Kerr stepped in between us. I got Ray Ellis was a defensive back on the Eagles. He hated me. He came after me. Greg Garrity rescued me that time. Those days, journalism days, it was part of the job. You were going to alienate people, so be it. After that, the only time it upset me if I found out that one of these sports figures hated me was if I was wrong. And I was wrong a few times along the way, and I deserved it for that. The rest of the time, the only thing that would bother me is if a fan was upset.
When were you wrong, Ange? When were you wrong?
The worst one I was wrong in, and I mentioned in the book, is that 1993, Jim Eisenreich, one of the great gentlemen who ever played in our city, we had a Philly Mag reporter there. And during a break, I basically was trying to get it Fregosi, Jim Fregosi, the manager. And I put into the mouth of Jim Eisenreich, who had nobly fought Tourette's syndrome and was a symbol of how you can overcome this kind of thing, put in his mind some vile things him saying about Fregosi. Vile. It was awful. And I still feel awful about it now, 30 years later. Mm-hmm. I would have been fired if it happened in the cancel culture today. But back then, it kind of just slipped through the cracks. But I did that. There were other times when I went over the line. I got personal in my attacks, and that was wrong. All I needed to do was focus on what was bothering me. The decision in the moment, the act by the athlete, the choke job like Simmons in the playoffs before we finally unloaded him, stuff like that. But if it was a fan I disappointed, that would hurt me more because that was my target audience. That's what I cared about. The players I didn't give a damn about, honestly. I didn't know them personally, and I either liked or disliked them based on what they were doing on the court or on the field.
By the way, I'm going to ask you about Ben Simmons because you've talked candidly about your own battle with clinical depression, right? And he clearly had his mental health issues, but I'm going to hold that.
Okay.
First, I want to talk about Donovan McNabb, the draft of 99. Background here, Eagles had the second pick. You take a group of people known as the Dirty 30, actually just 29, but I don't want to get into that. You're rooting for Ricky Williams to be picked, right? And all of a sudden, it's Donovan McNabb. Do you think McNabb ever got over the fact that he was booed the minute his name was mentioned?
Oh, no, he never got over it, which was indicative of the fact he was too sensitive to ever win a Super Bowl in Philadelphia. You got to get over that stuff. You just have to. You know, Carson Wentz was too weak. He couldn't handle the fact that suddenly the Eagles drafted another quarterback, Jalen Hurts, who ended up being way better than him. In Philadelphia, you got to have a tough skin. Was that, you know what? Part of me regrets it because it did ruin a moment for an athlete who had earned that moment. It was bad, but it wasn't intended as an attack on McNabb. It was disappointment, you know, fueled by the mayor of the city, Ed Rendell, who really loved Ricky Williams. The point we were not aware of the fact that Ricky had such an affection for pot. I was unaware of that at that time, but, he never got over it because he came on my TV show. He never came on my radio show. He came on my TV show. And he sat down and we did a very cordial segment. And I apologized to him profusely. And we went to break. I don't know if this ever happened to you, Mark, but stone silence.
Speaking of stone and pot, you have admitted your own use of cannabis for medical purposes, I will add, all related to the clinical depression. I'm going to try to get into that if I have time. I have so much stuff here.
Right.
Howard Eskin.
Yeah.
Howard Eskin. Ange, you wrote exactly one short paragraph on Howard. You said, quote, "Never have I had more of a love-hate relationship than with the dean of Philadelphia sports talkers," meaning Eskin, why did you spare the rod on Howard? We know you guys had disagreements over the years. Come on.
More than any. That was my number one guy to feud with. But
so what are we talking about here? Right. One small paragraph.
Decks are clean. We're done here, right? Now I got to say this. Do I rip him apart for the fact that there were times when we were not on the same page for representing our station? Or do I give him the credit for being the true pioneer in Philadelphia sports talk? He basically gave us all the blueprint on how to do it. He was negative before anyone was negative. He was out there. His neck was on the line. So, yeah, I could have gotten him for his ridiculous affection for the Eagles in the past 15 years or so. It was too much. I could have got him for a lot of other stuff, but I went, you know what? I got other guys that I hate way more than Howard. Howard, I respect. I respect the fact that Howard Eskin knew how to do this job before any of us did. And when I weighed it all together, I went, there's more positive than negative. I'm not going to kill him. Because the truth is, man, I'll tell you, man, he's had a hell of a career. And without him, none of us have the careers that we had. So he's in the plus side for me, even though he's in my hate chapter.
Love, hate, like you said. Wing Bowl, local cultural phenomenon. Why?
I have no idea. It was not the plan. we did not go. Yeah, I think we'll get 20,000 people in an arena at 6 o'clock every Friday before Super Bowl, and they'll want to watch fat guys eat chicken wings. No, it was not the plan. I cannot explain it. I never could explain it. I know that for the middle years of it, from like Wing Bowl 9 to Wing Bowl 20, it was a phenomenon like nothing you would ever imagine. And it got worldwide press. It was the best radio promotion, the best annual radio promotion maybe in the history of the medium. And then the world got more politically correct. The event did not. And it became something that we started to feel ambivalent about. And then toward the very end, negative toward. And that's why when the Eagles won the Super Bowl, we said it's time to go. But don't mistake this. I am proud that we put on that promotion and connected with our city the way we did for so many years. It's in my plus side too.
Well, we're going to talk about our favorite team, the Philadelphia 76ers, our favorite NBA club, in just a moment. But first, it's our halftime segment. This or that. I got a six-pack here. You have to choose between two things. Are you ready?
Yes.
Here we go. Philly cheesesteak or Philly soft pretzel?
Cheesesteak.
Center City or South Jersey?
Center City.
Gritty or Philly fanatic?
Fanatic.
Meek Mill or Hall & Oates?
Hall & Oates, even though they're fighting.
Yeah, for sure. Dr. J or Allen Iverson throwback?
Allen Iverson.
Liberty Bell or Rocky Steps?
Rocky Steps.
All right, here's my music library. A handful of artists. You tell me if you have them as well. You ready?
I got a lot of music.
Well, here you go, brother. The Doors.
Got him.
Van Halen.
No. John.
Wow.
One song. Jump.
Okay. Miles Davis.
No. Though I love his work. I love him for
the
movie.
Yeah. All right. And I'm a jazz guy. Diana Krall.
No.
She's jazz. Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Yes.
Who are your musical go-tos, Angelo Cataldi?
Musical go-tos. Wow. I have so much stuff. I am a blues guy now.
Danny
Bryant, Canadian blues guy. One of the greatest I've ever heard doing anything. Yeah, Joe Bonamassa. I'm into long guitar riffs. Love that stuff. I still like folk rock. I listen to Kathleen Edwards a lot. I get a lot of different stuff, but
Are you a Buddy Guy guy?
Not so much.
You talk about
one of my all-time favorite songs, B.B. King. The Thrill Is Gone. Nobody does it like B.B. King. Nobody.
All right, let's do some Sixers, shall we?
Yes,
it's our favorite childhood team. All right, here we go. I need your thoughts, James Harden. Just your thoughts. Oh, go.
Please. It's like having a tumor removed. It was a great decision to get rid of him finally. I don't know why they brought him here.
Ben Simmons, you talk extensively in your book about clinical depression. Listen, it's fair to say that Ben has had his share of mental health issues. Doesn't he deserve a break for that?
He was a lot of that surfaced at the very end of his time here. He was a spoiled brat who was basically enabled by a coach.
Is that his fault? Is that his fault?
Well, it's Brett Brown's fault for favoring the fact that he played with his father. Ben Simmons, to me, he was the biggest enigma this city's ever had, because there's no arguing the talent. It's there. He just needed to develop the shot a little bit. He needed to accept what his flaws were and improve on them. And if he had just done that, he would have been phenomenal here. And you know what? We would have had a parade, maybe a couple. But he just, he's so obstinate. It was just, I don't know. He was a terrible fit for this city.
There's a chapter in your book, Enemies for Life. You mentioned Brett Brown, quote, a wonderful man.
Yes.
Who actually called you while you were on the beach one day in Sea Isle. Yeah. What was that all about?
He wanted to explain to me how they lost that series against Boston. It came down to a play under the basket, and I guess Covington didn't cover it right. He went on for like 20 minutes. I think he had like a blackboard in front of me. He was designing plays for me. At the end, I went, hey, Brett, I'll be honest with you, you lost. No one cares how you lost. You lost. And Brett Brown, you won't find a nicer man. He's a loser. He came here to lose. He did one thing well here. He lost the process.
Right. And I'll just argue on behalf of him, and I'm not going to go to the mat with you on this. I want to move on. But, you know, he was brought here to babysit those early teams. And well, we know what that was all about. But I'm moving on. The process. Let's speak of the process in general. Is it time to judge it?
I guess people are still waiting. Embiid's still here. Until Embiid's gone, I guess you could continue to evaluate it. But it was 4 years of our life we'll never get back. Especially you. You had to watch every minute of it.
But I was paid to be there, remember.
I know you were paid to be there, but I don't know. They should have given you a raise for those years. They were trying to lose in our city. And here we are now, a long time after that, 6 years maybe, we still don't have a parade. We need a parade or it failed. And I guess now it's on the shoulders of one man, Joel Embiid, who I love, by the way.
Well, yeah, me too. It was on the shoulders of Allen Iverson. He got close to helping to deliver a parade. In all of your Philadelphia athletes that you encountered over the years, what is his stature?
For entertainment, number one. I love watching him play. We had him on a couple of times. As a talk show host, he was a gift as well, because he always had something else going on. I think we milk 4 months out of the practice news conference. We talk about practice and so much other stuff. Man, I loved watching them. They got up 1-0 on the Lakers that year. And if they could win this series, it'd be the greatest thing that ever happened in Philadelphia. And then they didn't win another game. I loved him. I loved his attitude. He came on our show. He was a gentleman. He was quirky. He was crazy. But he was a guy you couldn't take your eyes off.
True. Very true. Could get up shots like nobody else. Played basketball like football. But I got to move on here.
Yeah.
You write extensively. I want to talk about clinical depression. You write extensively in your book about battling clinical depression. How did that affect your work?
Well, for a while, a lot. 1995, Tom Brookshire has left me. Tony Bruno's contract's running out, and I'm going to have to do a radio show not knowing how to do radio. I had Al with me, but he also didn't know how to do radio. And my insecurity led to what happened. I've had enough therapy now to know that. And I got to the point where I couldn't function. I took 3 weeks off to get some help. I went on antidepressants and returned tentatively for quite a while until I got my footing back. And once you have had it at the level that I did, which was pretty serious, you fear it for the rest of your life because you don't feel you have any power over it when it takes over you. And I've had a couple of bouts with it since, but much less. I now have tools to deal with it that I didn't have the first time. But it was basically insecurity. And the fact that I thought now, imposter syndrome, now they're going to realize I don't have a clue what I'm doing. Really, that's what it was.
You mentioned tools to deal with clinical depression, among them medical cannabis. You use it? Is it helping?
Not just medical. I use it for fun, too. All right.
Okay. All right. Well, do tell then.
It's legal.
Do tell.
I got 10 years ago, I tried it. I got a medical marijuana card in LA. I was on Venice Beach. And I said, you know what? I want to try this. And I convinced my wife to do it with me. And we tried it. And I liked the feeling of it. And I went, this is the most relaxed I've ever been. I'm a hyper human being. So I came back. I kind of let it slip for years. And then it became legalized. And I started using it again. And now a week does not go by or I won't take one toke over the line, sweet Jesus.
Yeah. Are you straight for this or did you take a little hit before we started?
No, you're going to have to evaluate that. Something tells me you're pretty good at knowing the truth on that. Mark Tumor.
Well, let me just say we're moving on. listen, I'm a sucker for a good love story.
Yeah.
Your second wife, Gail, you're doing a promotion. You're on a billboard. This is in the book on I-95. You're starving. And what does she do that makes you really fall in love with her?
We're teetering on a billboard. It doesn't have like a really firm base. From a tree coming out, there's this, like this lift truck, and she's in the bucket of it. And she emerges from the tree holding soft pretzels. Now, granted, a cheesesteak would have been nicer. but I went, wow, that may be the one. And 23 years later, she's still the one. So it worked. It was great.
Awesome.
It was great.
I love it. Retirement. Steve Mix once said to me, you know it's time to retire when you see that rebound and you say, fuck it, let somebody else get it.
That's great.
Did you? Yeah. I love it. I use it all the time. Did you have a moment like that?
It started after the Eagles won the Super Bowl because I knew I'd experienced the greatest thing I could ever hope to get. And it was everything I could have hoped it would be. So now it's 2018 and I'm going, wow, I'm getting close to 70 years old. I got to start thinking about it. And then COVID hit and there was a lot of period there where you wanted to help the station through a horrible time because we were a sports station for a while. There was zero sports. So we got through that. And then I said, okay, it's time. And then they asked me for one more year. And so I fleeced them pretty good on that last contract. And I came back. At that point, I was getting along great with my bosses, so I didn't need any of those clauses. But Mark, you got to know. And, you know, I know you did it earlier than I did. And you got to know. And within a few months, you probably will know. And now it's been 9 for me. And I'm positive it was the right thing. It was just, I had done it for 33 years. I did it as hard, as strong as I could. And it was time. And I have zero regrets about leaving, especially around 5 o'clock every morning when I turn over and go back to sleep.
Right. Ange, what does it say about Philadelphia sports fans? You said this in your book. Many of them hated you, but when you announced your retirement, many of them loved you. What does that say about them?
Yeah, and you fell into the trap too. You call me a legend. I say that word is synonymous with old.
Yes, you know, no doubt.
The fans, it's funny. Even the sports figures, Mark, they were nicer to me. The Eagles and the Phillies honored me on the field. I threw out a first pitch. I was out at the Eagles game. I was an honorary captain and all that. And I guess what you'd love to believe, whether it's true or not, is that at the very end, when they realized you would no longer be a threat, you would no longer cause them all the angst that I did, that you did your job as well as you could for a long time and fans must have liked you. They kept you around. And that's all I want. That's plenty for me.
Yeah, yeah. I have to say, you put it out there. In fact, you once did a live broadcast of your own breast reduction surgery. Why would you do that?
Because at the time, we were seeking any way we could to get attention. Anything we could possibly come up with that people would write about or give us some attention for. Those were the formative years. You had to stake your claim to some of the media territory that the fans populated. And that's all we were trying to do back then. And I got flatter breasts out of it. So it worked out great.
Ange, you know, you said you're in your 70s. I'm headed to that milepost myself. Should we all be laughing at ourselves more? You've talked about cancel culture. Should we all be laughing at ourselves more, perhaps a little bit less concerned about being politically correct?
Truer words have not been spoken, Mark. That's the truth of it. We are currently in an era where we don't laugh at ourselves enough. And the one thing I learned to do very early on is to realize that I needed to let the audience know that I was full of it, that these are my opinions and they have no more value than yours. That somebody gave me a mic. And I wish I assume the pendulum will swing at some point. But it seems like now in this era of social media, everybody is lying in wait to see the next thing they can get angry about. And most of these things, the people that are saying them don't even mean them. They're a momentary lapse and they shouldn't lose a career over it. Now, I really hope that we get back to a point where we can laugh more at ourselves.
I love it. The book is loud, yet I'm hearing you soft-spoken. It's awesome. Mm. You have some book signings coming up in December. Go ahead and pitch them.
Yeah, I don't have the list in front of me, but anywhere, if you live in this area, I'm still working on Delaware. If you live anywhere else in this area, I will be there. Go to angelocataldi.com. Also, you can order the hardbound version of this with a personalized message. Like I would write to Mark Zumwalt, the greatest Sixer play-by-play person ever, Angelo Cataldi. But I'm even getting some that are denigrating the Dallas Cowboys, and I'm whatever they want, I'm writing it down. Because you know,
the book
check cleared. Why not?
Why not? Loud. The book is called Loud. How a Shy Nerd Came to Philadelphia, Turned Up the Volume in the Most Passionate Sports City in America, The Forward, by the way, by Ray Didinger. Great choice. Angelo Cataldi, loved it, man. Mark, thanks so much. All the best with the book. Good luck in retirement.
You're great
friend.
At this. I can't thank you enough for letting me do this, Mark, and it was a great joy. Thank you.
You got it. Check out our friends over at Philadelphia Sports Nation, a local Philadelphia sports site. Covering your favorite teams across blogs and social media. PHLSportsNation.com. Philadelphia Sports Nation. PHL Sports Nation. Enhancing your Philadelphia sports fan experience. Hey guys, thanks for listening to this episode of Fresh 24. Please subscribe, rate, and review wherever you get your podcasts.